Okay, so.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
Hey, Maria.
Hey, Zakia.
So, I know you're not a sports fan.
Yes, I know nothing about sports. Very, very little.
I'm wondering, have you heard anything about this?
The Linsanity continues. The Jeremy Lin phenomenon that has swept the nation.
Is any of that familiar to you? So this is a safe space. You can say
okay,
no.
So I think it's Jeremy Lin. He plays basketball.
Yes.
I don't know what team he plays for.
Yeah, so he's on the Nets now. But back in 2012, when he was on the New York Knicks, he was a phenomenon. Basically, he just came out of nowhere and started making tons of dramatic game-winning shots and became the biggest Asian-American basketball star in the league. But he's not just famous for Linsanity. Over the last few years, he's gotten pretty famous for something else.
Here is Lin. You'll have no trouble noticing him with the hairdo.
He looks like a comic book character.
Looks like he stuck his finger in an electrical socket.
What?
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to show you a picture of what he looks like now.
Oh. So he's got dreadlocks, and he's got them pulled back into kind of a high ponytail. And it's shaved on either side. To me, I'm like, it looks okay, but I guess I might be sticking my foot into a major controversy right now. I'm getting that feeling.
And, you know, that's part of it. Like, some people are like, oh, he looks good, right on. And other people are like, no. Dreadlocks have a really politicized history. Dreads first got popular in the U.S. in the 70s when Bob Marley came on the scene. They were this Rastafarian religious symbol, and a lot of Black people started wearing dreads to connect with their African roots. But Black people have gotten a lot of pushback, too. You know, as recently as 2016, courts defended the rights of a company who refused to hire someone just because they were wearing dreads.
And that's just the hairstyle.
Yeah, but it's more than that. And Jeremy Lin gets that, too. So he wrote an article all about it for the Players Tribune. He heard people's concerns, and he actually understood it. And he even wrote, quote, "I know what it feels like when people get my culture wrong. I know how much it bothers me when Hollywood relegates Asian people to token sidekicks."
So if he's such a thoughtful guy, you know, thinking about his hair a lot, obviously, why dreads?
He likes to use his hair as like a, you know, form of self-expression to push himself out of his comfort zone. And he was out one time and he saw this Taiwanese man with dreadlocks. And he was like, oh, that looks pretty cool. And then he's talking with his Black teammates, and they and some other staff members encouraged him to go for it. And they're like, you know, as long as you understand the significance of the dreads and the history. So he decided to do it. But he's still not sure if it was the right call in the end.
So I had an interesting reaction, but what about other people? Were they like, yeah, thumbs up, it looks good? Or were they like, how dare you?
Well,
all right, bro, we get it. We get it. Like, you want to be Black, but the last name is Lin. All right?
Whoa.
Yeah. So that is Kenyon Martin. He is a former basketball player. He's African-American, and he took to Instagram. But Jeremy Lin tweeted, quote, "I appreciate that I have dreads and that you have Chinese tattoos."
Oh, my God. Whoa. So this is like, you know, the cultural appropriation war.
You have two people of color, you know, appropriating each other's cultures. One is saying, hey, this is a form of appreciation. And the other one's like, hey, you're taking my culture. You know, Kenyon Martin ended up apologizing. And even Jeremy Lin knows that there's no easy answer to this.
Getting dreadlocks is not as simple as just getting dreadlocks. Like, what I've been learning and reading is there's actually a lot of people who have received some type of discrimination because of that. And so being aware of these issues brings us to a better place where we further understand each other. Maybe something that's missing right now.
He's grappling with it in real time. And the takeaway from his article is like, you know what? This is such a contentious thing. Let's have an open dialogue about it.
And that's exactly what we're going to do on today's show. We're going to have an open dialogue on the ins and outs of cultural appropriation, which is, of course, a great Halloween tradition. And you've probably seen it yourself when you've seen somebody who is not Latino wearing a sombrero or in Day of the Dead calavera makeup during this time of the year. Now, cultural appropriation basically is when an individual from one culture adopts elements from another culture. I mean, this could be clothes, it could be food, it could be language, etc., etc. But today, we're not going to focus on white people and cultural appropriation, but rather the confusing and murky world of POC on POC appropriation. But first, Sakia, you actually sat down and you had exactly the kind of conversation that Jeremy Lin was talking about. So what happened?
So, you know, Maria, this is something that I've been thinking about for years. So I decided to get a few people together and have a conversation about it. So I talked to Brianna Gray, a writer and the host of the podcast Someone's Wrong on the Internet, John McWhorter, a professor of linguistics at Columbia and host of Slate's podcast Lexicon Valley, and multimedia journalist Walter Thompson Hernandez. Now, I started off talking with just Brianna and John, but you'll be hearing from Walter as well in a little bit. So in October of 2015, Yale University sent out a letter to its students cautioning them against wearing culturally insensitive Halloween costumes, you know, ones that could offend students of color. Yale lecturer Erica Christakis pushed back and sent out a campus-wide response. She defended students' rights to wear what they want, even if it is offensive. So the question is, how do you negotiate one person's right to wear what they want, but on the other hand, be sensitive to not offending people? Brianna, let's start with you. What do you think?
The issue with Erica's email is that it pretended as though the initial email warning students that, hey, you might offend your peers if you wear certain kinds of costumes was forbidding student behavior, or students were going to be sanctioned or expelled. Since that wasn't the case, Erica's email came off as defending something that didn't need defending.
That's very true. But I think what struck many people was why anybody would be that viciously angry at something like what Erica Christakis wrote. And I think that many people are perplexed that any grown-up would be cursed at, or that Erica Christakis would essentially be hounded out of her job.
I have a lot, I think, a little bit more empathy for the passion behind the response. The fact that she wrote it seemingly as though we were living in a vacuum, in which the idea that students at a prestigious university don't routinely dress up in a way that caricatures the identities of their peers, and that that doesn't have like real psychic effect, and that doesn't reflect a greater sense of being marginalized on a historically white campus like Yale's. I think that's where the venom came from.
You know, I would push back a little bit, because I think that sometimes the way this is discussed makes it sound as if to be a student of color on a modern college campus is to, on Halloween, watch people regularly walking around blacked up. These things aren't as cut and dried as, say, people at a sit-in in 1962, where if anybody walked up to them and said, you know, there are other ways of looking at this, must you sit there and insist on your hamburger? I think we would all say no. The issue was rather clear.
So I think that most in this panel who've, you know, been on a college campus in the last, you know, 10 years or so, have seen, if not someone blacked up during Halloween, someone wearing some kind of Mexican costume with a giant hat and a mustache. That is disrespectful in a way that is pretty easy to understand. A letter that says, be sensitive to this kind of thing, I think that that's appropriate.
So talking about appropriating fashion and style, I wanted to get y'all's thoughts on, you know, what went down between Jeremy Lin and Kenyon Martin. And just so that we're all on the same page, Lin is a Chinese-American basketball player who got dreads. And then Kenyon Martin, who's a black player, accused him of cultural appropriation. And then Jeremy Lin clapped back and said that Martin is actually covered in tattoos of Chinese characters.
I think that that was a sick burn on the part of Jeremy Lin. And I think that the point here is an exchange is a two-way street. If there are two ethnic minorities involved, then what is the relationship between those two groups? Is there a historical relationship where there is an imbalance of power, which makes us question whether or not locks are being, you know, privileged because they're being used by Jeremy Lin as opposed to a black person, or Chinese characters being privileged because they're being worn by a black person instead of by an Asian person. So with respect to Jeremy Lin, you know, I don't have the same kind of visceral reaction that I might if a white person did it. And I also think what it's about is whether or not it frustrates people because it reflects a sense in which greater society, things which are black, aren't valued until they're adopted by non-black people.
But I think that the issue of appreciation is important, because it seems to me that we're asking that somebody like Jeremy Lin, he can appreciate them by saying, boy, those look nice, but he better not wear them. And Jeremy asks, well, why? And you say, well, because if you wear them, it's going to stand out in a way that it wouldn't if a black person wore them. And therefore, that means that you're profiting because people are looking at you. And also, you're erasing the black person. And do you notice how it seems like we've come up with this way of talking about this that I'm not sure would necessarily make sense to somebody who was brought in from the outside? I think I understand what people are meaning, but to be honest, I worry about pride. It seems to me that if you think that somebody imitating you threatens to erase you, doesn't that suggest that you kind of thought you didn't exist?
So, John, my pushback is you behave as though there hasn't been a long history of black accomplishment and black innovation being erased and subsumed into a broader white identity. That erasure feeds into this idea culture started recently, and that there's not this long, you know, centuries and centuries of histories in which math and science and musical instruments and pasta and paisley, all of these came from brown cultures. And it enables people to persist in and perpetuate a kind of a white supremacy. And so when we fight these smaller battles about locks, it's not about what an individual can and cannot do. Nobody is prohibiting anybody from doing anything. No one's going to be lynched in the street for being a white guy with dreadlocks. But to have these conversations and let white people or people like Jeremy Lin be aware of the fact that there is a risk that they might be perpetuating a kind of erasure that other people might find problematic, I think is healthy.
All right, so we've been touching on it, but let's talk specifically about cultural appropriation between communities of color. So how does this work? How do we approach something like this?
Well, it seems to me that we have to make sure to distinguish between exchange from above and exchange from below, because I think many people hear that question and they say, is there something wrong with the fact that Latino people or black people now do this thing that white people did? And a standard answer, and I think I understand it, is that, well, that was oppressed people taking something from the oppressors. And so some people might have the radical position that there shouldn't have been cultural exchange over the past several millennia. But I think most of us would say, for example, that we're glad that there's jazz and there's rock and roll. And that, frankly, is white people stealing, as we would say today, from black people. And then black people taking it up and making it better. And so if we can't have white people wearing dreadlocks today, then we can't have jazz and we can't have rock and roll. I'm not sure how many people would say that those things shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, I think this is a really fascinating question because it comes up a lot in my life. I'm going to a wedding of an Indian friend in India, and we're all supposed to go sari shopping. And I've been thinking about, well, now I'm out here on the internet as this, you know, somebody knowledgeable about cultural appropriation. What's it going to look like when I turn up on Facebook and all these pictures of a sari, you know? And again, you have to examine what the kind of relationship is between the two people of color and see of whether or not what you're doing is at all exploitative or disrespectful. And I think, you know, I've come to terms with, if I'm going to a wedding of a long-term friend in a country where everybody's wearing this and this is just showing respect to blend in and adhere to custom, well, that's one thing. If I were to take the expensive, nice dress that I buy for this wedding and then wear it for Halloween next year, that would be problematic. The idea that culture and race are coterminous is part of the problem, right? So there are things that are seen to be a part of black culture that I, as a black person, might not have particularly affinity for, and which my boyfriend, who's Chinese American, who was raised in a predominantly black and Latino environment in the Bronx, might actually have an affinity for. And it's an ongoing question for me how much one's personal exposure, you know, if you're an Eminem who grew up in a certain environment, do you have more entitlement to that culture regardless of being white?
We're going to have a problem here. Y'all act like you've never seen a white person before. Jaws all on the floor like
pants. And someone who grew up in an upper middle class environment, or like myself, who grew up overseas, has to that same, you know, quote unquote culture, because it's also really entwined with class.
Yeah. So I actually want to get into some of the language stuff that you brought up, Brianna. And I want to specifically talk about Latino rappers and the N-word. You know, it's like pretty commonly held, like if you're not black, you can't say it. But and then there's some people who are like, well, there's some exceptions, like Fat Joe, he can say it, but Jennifer Lopez, she can't. So for this part of the conversation, I want to bring in Walter Thompson Hernandez, who actually wrote an article on this exact topic.
Yeah. So I watched this interview with Cardi B, right, who was interviewed by a DJ named DJ Vlad, who has his own like YouTube channel called DJ Vlad TV. And he kind of, you know, asked Cardi B, he was like, well, you know, how do you feel about Latinas, Latinos and the N-word, you know?
And Cardi B is Dominican.
And I think her mother's from Trinidad, right? I write about how Big Pun, you know, rest in peace, and like Fat Joe use the N-word and like have been sort of questioned about it, right?
Fat Joe is Puerto Rican and Cuban.
And Big Pun is Puerto Rican, exactly. I kind of like preface all that by saying that, you know, I grew up in like a very sort of black and brown environment in South LA and throughout Los Angeles, where both non-black Latinos, particularly Mexicans and Central Americans, were using the N-word around black folks. And there was a sort of like a fluid way that we all kind of used the word, right? But then you also have Latinos who are Afro-Latinos, right? Who are Latinos of African descent, who are often racialized in the U.S. as black Americans. So, you know, the word is often, it gets murky because you're like, yeah, you are ethnically Latino, but racially you're black, right? It's very complicated, and it's a debate and a dialogue that I think will not be ending soon.
So some people are like, it's not appropriation if you've lived that experience. Mm-hmm. So if they have, but they're not black, does that give them license to use the N-word?
Okay, you have folks in the academy who are academics and who are in popular culture who feel a certain way about it, but there are people in the hood who don't have access to that information and to that knowledge and to that lexicon, right? So they have a different experience, a very sort of real experience where, you know, they're being, you know, harassed on the police by cops and being mm-hmm. killed by police. And so black and brown folks often feel a solidarity there. And so the word often connects people more than it doesn't.
But what if you have someone who is black, but like grew up wealthy and in Vermont and has a completely different life experience? Do they have as much of a right to say it or less? And does life experience count for more than racial identity?
Part of it is, for me, has always been, can this hurt you as much as it hurts me? I'm not ever going to be as offended if a black person says the N-word as a non-black person, just point blank, period. However, I do think race and class are seen to be overlapping, and they're not. And there's a way that we talk about black people in America that assumes a certain kind of class-based cultural background that is not necessarily true to all black people. And I know that as someone who like grew up abroad and like missed the entire 90s and came to college with like an embarrassingly, you know, low amount of like hip hop knowledge, that, you know, it feels wrong to me to use certain kinds of jargon and to like appropriate, you know, certain kinds of lingo or pretend to be something that I'm not. And in the same way that it's, you know, classist and inappropriate for, you know, all these middle class, upper middle class, wealthy white people to be talking about white trash yokels all the time and affecting a country twang.
John?
I think that the word has become a lot more complicated than it used to be. I think another way of looking at it is that this rich black person from Vermont, there are very few people who actually fit that description, but that, that person would be considered to be able to use it however they wanted to, because it's generally said that there are certain experiences that a person black has no matter what. But I find particularly interesting the fact that the word has come to mean buddy, and it's been used that way by black people really forever. It's not something that just started with rap music. This is something that goes back to the 19th century at least. And then what happened is that, first of all, many Latinos started using it in the same way because they felt that there was a large overlap between their culture and black culture. And then because there's a browning of the culture that has particularly happened since about 1995, a lot of, you know, even white people, men in particular, feel comfortable using that word to mean buddy because they feel that there's something of a black person inside of them. And all that's very complicated. And I still feel strange when I see especially white boys doing that. But, you know, to tell you the truth, we can have this discussion, but I'm not sure we can control how they use the N-word.
So one of the things that I absolutely love millennials, and I love the fact that millennials are so hypercritical of everything. I think it is a manifestation of a certain amount of privilege, right, to be able to dissect everything. Because I'm thinking about, like, when I was experiencing cultural appropriation, it was like eye roll after eye roll after eye roll. But it was never a, there was never a conversation about it. It just was like an invisible conversation. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just really happy that people are talking about it, because this stuff is really complicated. It's multi-leveled. And I'm hesitant to be the one that says, I'm the decider, this is good, this is bad, because that's challenging too.
And also you have to think, like, how productive is it to be like, this is good, this is bad? And I feel like that's part of the reason why we keep having the same conversation over and over again, like why people keep wearing these costumes over and over again. And in my research, I was talking to this one professor, Professor Pham, and she was saying that a problem with this whole issue of cultural appropriation is how we talk about it. And sometimes we just, it's just the word has grown into something that's too much of a catch-all. And so we're not even really pinpointing what the issue is. She was like, is that cultural appropriation or is it just racism or is it appreciation? You know, and I think that people don't understand the nuances that comes with cultural appropriation. It's not just good or bad, but like Brianna pointed out, what's this, the historical relationship of these two groups? You know, what are the power differentials? Is this cultural exchange and not appropriation? And, you know, Professor McWhorter, John McWhorter, was saying that, you know, we're getting into this territory of a take no prisoners response. And, you know, I agree with you, Maria, that like sometimes it's, I think we need to get away from don't do that, this is bad. We actually need to have a dialogue and open up about like the intricacies of this hot button issue.
Zakiya, thanks for that roundtable.
No problem.